Let's get started. So welcome to the PMFA Best Practice Operations Webinar. So we're calling it a webinar now instead of call because I've got a PowerPoint presentation going, and also we've got the video conferencing going as well. So if you want to join in with the PowerPoint or the video conferencing, you can go to freeconferencecall.com/JoelSmith123. I think there should be a link in with your invite as well, so you can log on to that if you'd like. And you can visually see what I'm talking about. So we will be hosting this call on every fourth Monday of each month at 11 a.m. Central Time. It's going to last approximately 45 minutes to an hour, depending on how much discussion time we have. So the three purposes that we have for this training call is, number one, to help owners work on our businesses and not just in it by leveraging our talents, priorities, and opportunities. Number two, to share systems and strategies that drive profitability so that we can not only survive, but thrive. And number three, to have a place where franchisees, multi-unit leaders, general managers, assistant managers, anybody, can come and learn and share best practices and ask questions and be supported. So that's the whole purpose behind this, and we'll get started here. So I think we'll begin with the slide. All right, so we are in the third month of a four-month series called Think and Be Productive. See, if we're going to be productive, if we're going to be successful in any way, it has to come from good thinking. Usually bad thinking leads to bad things. And so this whole thing is just to really help you think in a way that maybe you haven't thought in at other times, or just to challenge you to think outside the box. So in January, we talked about vision, how necessary it is to have a vision of your desired outcome, you know, starting with the end in mind kind of thing. In February, we talked about planning first and producing second, and that was pretty important too. We need to have an idea of what's going on before we jump into it. It creates a plan of action and order as opposed to chaos. And so those first 2 months were the planning stage. So that was all figuring out a plan and figuring out how to think before you even do anything. Today is our third month in March, and this presentation is rules for back of house production. So now we're going to actually start doing stuff. We're going to talk about different things that we can do while we're working in the back of house to make us more production. Just some simple principles, that type of thing. In April next month, we'll talk about the rules for the front of house production. So that'll be interesting. So first of all, let's talk about the problem. The problem with productivity. So the average worker in the service industry wastes somewhere between 20 and 30% of their time trying to figure out what to do next. Kind of depends on what statistics you look at, but it's pretty consistent that we waste a lot of time in the restaurant business. 20 and 30%, that's a ton. If you just add that up over the course of a year, I'm just afraid to imagine how much waste we have of time, especially if you're a multiple store owner or a high volume owner. We waste more time doing tasks out of order, working in a messy environment, or allowing social media and non-relevant chatter to cause us to lose focus. Losing focus is a big, big thing. And a lot of times when we don't connect with our people well, we don't communicate well, that'll happen. So all of these things can be helped by us making a good connection with our people. So that I'm going to give you some tools here. We settle into inefficient patterns that depreciate our efficiency. These patterns become bad habits, and bad habits are very expensive. It's amazing how fast these expenses pile up, and we don't even know it usually. Sometimes we don't really sit down to take the time to figure out how much time we're actually wasting by the way that we're going about things. So my challenge to you today would be to, when you walk away from here, to give it some thought. Give it some thought, take some of these things, these ideas that we're talking about, and see if you can apply them to your stores. Most leaders in the service industry don't even realize when they're stuck in patterns of inefficiency. They either don't know any better, or they have their face stuck in the cheese and they lack perspective. So it's easy just not to notice. Today's objective, I want to give you a few guardrails to keep you to help you establish a more intentional and systematic approach towards your back of house production. I also want to increase your team's natural pace of production using consistent time framing as a technique. So we'll talk about time framing in a little while. You'll need to be willing to challenge your ideas and allow yourself to consider new ideas. A couple of things that I talk about, you might kind of say, wait a minute, hold on, I do that. There's nothing wrong with that. But I challenge you just to hear me out and listen and be willing to consider some other ideas as well. Sometimes we need to let go of seemingly good ideas to make room for better ones. So, all right, let's get started here. So there are four rules to production that I want to talk about today. The first one, and this is one that some of you out there might not like to hear this, okay? We talked about four or five different kinds of unproductive people. One of those was the busybody, the person that kind of runs around, does a lot of things. A lot of times those people are multitaskers. So rule number one is resist the multitasking myth. So some of you might say, wait a minute, I'm a great multitasker. I get things done. I'm fast. I'm efficient. I do all this. Maybe so, but hear me out. So multitasking gives the illusion of competence and productivity, but it's actually a detriment to your productivity. A lot of people misunderstand what multitasking really is also. Now, what I'm not saying about multitasking is that we shouldn't make use of our time when we're using a Hobart. You know, we're the dough's mixing and we need to use that time. You know, we need to use that time when we're filling up a sink or doing other different things. We need to be making use of that time. But that's not multitasking. That's just using another entity like a Hobart or something else to do parallel tasking that's working at the same time as you. So I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't multitask in that sense. But I am suggesting that the human brain really can't focus on anything more than one thing at a time. And sometimes we're fooled into thinking that multitasking actually makes us more efficient, and it really doesn't. It slows us down, and we have all kinds of problems with that. So multitasking leads to multiple products sitting out simultaneously at times. We need to bring our product out of the cooler and get it put back in the cooler quickly. One way that I see in our stores sometimes people trying to multitask that they get in trouble would be they'll just have multiple products out on the tables. I'll walk into a store in the middle of the afternoon and there'll be a case of tomatoes sitting on the prep table and they're in the middle of doing cheese and there's still dough needing to be sheeted and there's just one individual person that's working and I wonder what's going on. And it's just a classic case of multitasking. You get involved with one thing and then you get a little bit busy and realize something else needs to be done and you're falling behind on this or that. Sometimes the planning stage, like we talked about last month, will really help to take care of that. In fact, these all work together. You can probably tell that. So sometimes multitasking leads to quality problems when products are sitting out. Another example of product quality and multitasking would be maybe we're doing a bunch of sauce and cheeses on the front line. And we have like crust pulled all the way across the line and they're all exposed to air and they're ready to be stretched. So we got like 8 or 10 or 12 crusts just ready to go and we're kind of saucing one at a time. We don't need to be doing that many at one time. Another example would be add-on sales, cheesy breads. Maybe you've got cheesy breads spread out across the whole front line, 10 or 12 of them, and we're kind of doing them all at once. That's multitasking. You're trying to do a whole bunch of these at one time. What I would recommend that you do with your add-on sales, for instance, would be when you sheet your add-on sales, sheet them in stacks of like 5 or 6 and to throw them in the cooler until you're ready to use them. And then when you make them, when you go up front to make them, pull them out in a stack and do one stack, get them in the cooler, pull up another stack, do them, get them in the cooler, pull up another stack, and so on until you're done. That way you don't have your food sitting out, being exposed to air and being exposed to temperature, and shortening your shelf life of that product. So that's one thought on food quality. Multitasking leads you to be making too many trips to the cooler or too many steps in the back room. It causes you to take extra time restarting tasks. Sometimes you're going to have some interruptions, and that's going to make you restart tasks. There's no sense in doing that even more, kind of forgetting where you're at and starting a new project and then that type of thing. So there's a lot of inefficiencies that take place because there's just way too many steps being taken. It would be interesting to take like one of those pedometer things that people use that count their steps, put those in the pocket of an efficient manager versus a not so efficient manager, and just see what the difference is. That would be interesting to me. I like to use my cart and a list to make use of a single trip to the cooler. I see so many times in the stores where somebody will take way too many trips to the walk-in cooler, especially maybe during a rush, proofing crusts or filling up the make line or gathering extra stock for down below the make line, that type thing. You'll see two or three people make a trip and grab one thing when we could be consolidating our efforts and using a cart and a list and just do it all at one time instead of all of these multiple tasks going on at one time. It's like chaos. And sometimes I'll watch a video of a rush, and I'll just see so many people just going back and forth. One thing we like to do with that is, and we'll talk about this more next month a little bit, but we like to give access rights to the cooler. So we have one person that makes access that can go back and forth to the cooler. That sometimes that can help. Multitasking leads to amplification of anxiety for those around you. Others despise working in your mess. So if you're a multitasker and you're kind of spinning around doing lots of different things and you're not very organized, you drive other people crazy. I'm one of those people that get driven crazy by that. I don't like to have chaos going on when I'm working in the back of the house, so I keep everything organized, and it's so much more efficient. You don't lose track of where things are. You don't forget about where you're at, all of that. So rule number one, resist the multitasking myth. All right. Rule number two, handcuffing or double teaming. This is something that has really revolutionized our company when we really started doing this. I started doing this before Papa Murphy's, but it really made a difference here. So double teaming on a task that takes more than 15 minutes, such as sheeting, chopping dough, shredding cheese, pre-makes, etc., that type of thing. So you're double teaming whenever you have two people. Obviously, sometimes you're going to have one person working, and you can't double team on that, of course, but we need to avoid the divide and conquer urge. Divide and conquer is really dangerous in this business in the sense that it can be a big time waster. Divide and conquer is another form of multitasking, but it's applied to multiple people. Okay, so this handcuffing is two people avoiding the divide and conquer urge. Okay. Here's one thing that I know. What one person can do in 2 hours, two can do in 45 minutes together. Now, that's a general statement, but I have timed that on different things like sheeting, for instance. I was able to time one person sheeting by themselves for 2 hours, and then the following day I timed that one person and an equal person sheeting together, and it actually took them 45 minutes to get done. And I think that's pretty consistent. That's for some reasons I'm going to talk about here in a minute. One word that we use in our company that I like to use is pillaging. So pillaging is when you attack a task aggressively using time goals and benchmarking. You finish it before moving on to the next task. So the word pillage, you think of like ancient civilizations. Let's say you've got an ancient civilization and they've got, you know, 1,000 different soldiers in their army, and there's 10 different other civilizations around that they want to conquer, and they all have around 100 soldiers in their armies. You could divide and conquer, send 100 out to each one, but you're probably going to lose half of your people. Or you could pillage. You could send all 1,000 soldiers to the first village and just wipe them out quickly, just run through them like a buzzsaw, and then move on to the next one and run through them, and you're going to have very little casualties. When you're done pillaging all 10 of those neighboring villages, you're going to have very little casualties, and you're going to just run through it so much more efficient than you would if you divide and conquer. So think about that. Use the word pillaging in your store. Teach people about it and try to think that way. It really works. We do this all the time in our company. One interesting thing about handcuffing, this is really important, so get this. There's always going to be a pace setter, okay? If you're going to handcuff or work side by side with somebody, one of those people are going to be faster than the other typically. In fact, sometimes it's the manager with a new person. Sometimes it's two veterans, whatever the case might be. One person's always going to be a little bit faster, and they're going to push the other person. See, when you divide and conquer, basically one person goes off and they do one thing on their own. Another person goes off and does another thing on their own. So you got one person chopping dough, another person cheating dough. And the one thing about when you don't handcuff, when you divide and conquer, is you get to just work at your own pace. So you can work slow. If you're slow, you can just go and work slow. When you are multitasking, or I'm sorry, when you are handcuffing, you're being pushed by somebody because you can't just go at your pace. You have to go at the pace of the fastest person. The fastest person wants to go faster, too. They want to show how fast they are. The other person doesn't want to be shown up, so they work a little bit faster, too. So it's training. It's helping to be a pace setter. So that's really important. Let's see. Depreciation of efficiency. So here's what I know. So when one person sheets dough for 2 hours straight, or chops dough for that matter, or any task probably, even doing cheese if you have a lot of cheese to do, the first couple of totes are much faster than the last ones. In other words, you start off working at this speed, and then after a while, your speed just kind of diminishes, and you end up working a lot slower. Some of that has to do with doing the same thing over and over and over, and we have limited attention, and so we just get bored by it. Sometimes physically, we can just get a little bit tired, but we just slow down. So I have a story about one of our stores years ago. I had a manager that hired a gal that didn't speak English. And so to make things easier, what she did is she just taught her how to sheet dough. So she was going to be the designated sheeter in the store. She's going to come in and work like Thursday through Sunday. And all she was going to do is come in and sheet dough and then go home. So I came in the store once and about 8 o'clock in the morning, and this new gal was there sheeting dough by herself. And the other couple of people, the manager and another prep person, were all doing all the other things. And so I noticed this gal was sheeting dough by herself. So then I left, had to run some errands and do whatever, came back a couple hours later, and this new gal was still there, and she was still sheeting dough, and she looked like death warmed over. She just looked like she was tired and just struggling and in pain, I don't know, but she was moving like a turtle with a broken leg. And so I kind of pulled the manager aside, and I asked her, I said, so are you guys handcuffing at all? Are you double teaming on this? And she said, no, this is what I hired her to do, so this is what she's going to do. And it was obvious that it was very inefficient that she was doing that. So we did change that, and we got that figured out. So she didn't have to just sheet dough all by herself on a Friday in a high-volume store and get burned out by that. So I think the idea behind handcuffing is that you take every individual task, try to make it as short as you can so you don't get bored and so it doesn't get tiring. If you can double-team or even triple-team sometimes with sheeting, sometimes we'll have a pounder, a sheeter and a wrapper, you can triple team, and you can just buzz through it quickly and get through that task, because sometimes these big tasks are just tasks that nobody wants to do because they're just unbearable. But when you double and triple team on it, you can make it bearable. You can get through it quickly and make it as harmless as possible. So that's important. Handcuffing promotes teamwork and interdependence. Someone is always stretched. So divide and conquer does not promote interdependence and teamwork. It promotes individualism. Handcuffing helps to illustrate how we are dependent on each other. We help each other up. We've all experienced that time when we're working with a person that we really gel with, where the other person's kind of just kind of filling in your gaps, and you're picking up where they left off, and you're bumping and sliding together, and it's just working efficiently. That's what we want to do. That's what we want to push for with handcuffing. So rule number two, handcuffing or double teaming. So rule number three, this is pretty simple, and I'm sure all of you know this, and some of you do this. Rule number three is clean as you go. As simple as a concept as this is, I see this being violated so much, not just in my stores, but just in the restaurant business in general. It's not unusual to see a stack of dishes piled up to the ceiling. So it's easy to be short-sighted and overlook cleaning up after ourselves. It can seem like we're delaying important prep duties when we take the extra time to clean up before moving on. So that's part of it, I think, is we get anxious and we want to move to the prep part. We want to get the prep done because in our minds that's most important. Who cares if we leave a few dishes in the back, because the customers will never see that. I've heard people talk about that before. But all we're doing with that, if we're really thinking that way, we're giving ourselves an excuse not to finish the job, not to finish everything. So we do need to clean as we go. We need to have our dishes, our counters, our equipment caught up before moving on. For example, one thing that I have in my company as a rule is we don't let more than 4 totes pile up. So we can sheet 4 totes of dough, and then we've got to go scrape and clean those totes and get those drying right away so that we don't end up with totes all the way up to the ceiling. It's really frustrating when the night people come in and they look in the back room and they see a big stack of totes all the way to the ceiling, and they have to go clean that. Another example of cleaning as you go would be just to clean your sheeter up right away when you're finished. Clean it up right away. Don't wait till 4 o'clock or till you're all done with your prep and then go finish cleaning up your equipment. Wipe down your equipment. Clean your dicers, your slicers, and get those cleaned up and put away. It's more efficient to work in a clean, sanitary environment than it is to work in clutter. I get really frustrated when I have to work in clutter. So there's been some people that I've worked with that have just been more frustrated with than others. And so it affects other people for sure. Everything has a home. Put utensils, dishes, equipment in their assigned places. If you don't know where something goes, get your little label maker out and put labels so that everybody knows where it goes. That'll help with your efficiency. When we're working in a clean, organized environment, we experience less anxiety and have a clearer mindset. That's true. When we're in a messy environment, we get anxious. There's something about that. Just there's anxiety that can take place when there's dishes piled up and there's messes around it. It seems like we're in a never-ending hole that's going to take a long time to get out of. When you clean as you go and you're working in a clean environment, there's a sense of ease that comes with that. Piles of dishes and messes create a feeling of being behind and cause unnecessary stress. Chaos builds on itself. Messes multiply. Tensions rise. So when you have a mess, it's really easy for that mess to become a bigger mess because it multiplies. All right, so rule number 3 is clean as you go. Rule number 4. This one is a little bit different. It's going to take some time to explain it so you understand what's going on. So rule number 4 is the 5-second rule, or what I call time framing. So no, it's not the 5-second rule of picking up product off the floor and, you got 5 seconds to eat it. No, it's not that one. So the 5-second rule or time framing, I'll get into a little bit more details of what that is, but new people, so think about this. You have a new person in your store. They're coming in. They're a little nervous. They're anxious. They're not sure what to do. They're just kind of standing around while somebody kind of leads them through the training process. New people are unsure of what's expected of them and fearful of making a mistake. That's just what's natural. They're just afraid of making a mistake. And they err on the side of perfection. So if you're teaching somebody how to make pizza, for instance, or chopping dough or anything, it doesn't matter, they're going to pay attention to how you're doing it. And the natural tendency for managers is to do it very slowly so that you teach them the right way and you explain as you go. And that's exactly the way it should be done. But sometimes we leave it there and we don't talk about speed on that first day or that first week. We just kind of let speed go because we don't want to make them nervous, that kind of thing. See, if we tell them how to do it and we emphasize quality and neglect helping them with the speed goals, they will get very, very good at being slow. See, the more you practice being slow, the more that speed becomes your normal. Okay? People will settle into their own normal based on what is expected of them. Okay? So if you teach people right up front to really focus on quality and not speed, and you don't change that and that stays that way, their normal is going to be slow and careful. Okay? The 5-second rule is like putting braces on performance. It creates a small, bearable amount of resistance over time to create a new normal. So the idea is we want to take somebody that has a normal speed of slow, and we want to increase that speed and make it faster. And so the 5-second rule is going to help with that. But we've got to do that from the very beginning. So here's areas to teach. These are some areas that we teach in the 5-second rule. So chopping dough is one of those areas. So the idea behind the 5-second rule is that when we're working in a Papa Murphy's, there's all kinds of different tasks that we can do that takes about 5 seconds to do. Maybe not exactly 5 seconds. Maybe some of them we can do in 3 seconds. Maybe it might be a stretch to get a few of these things done in 5 seconds. But the idea is that there's a whole bunch of little things to be done in 5 seconds. And so we want to change that expectation of our new people when they start and let them know that here are some of these things. So here's what I do. When I train a new person, I'll just let them know up front about the 5-second rule. I'll let them know that, hey, it's important that you get this down and do it the right way. And you don't have to be fast right away. You don't have to be fast today or tomorrow or even next week necessarily. You don't have to hit these goals. But I want to give you the goal that you want to get to. So when you're doing this task, you want to set your sights on being able to do it in 5 seconds or less. Okay? And if you can't, count and just keep working on it until you get to it. So the idea is that you're setting that vision out in front of them so it's something for them to work towards, but you also express to them that it's not expected that they hit it right away, but they need to work towards it. So let's look at chopping dough, for instance. It takes about 5 seconds to oil each tote. Now, I've seen people take 30 seconds to oil a tote. You guys have probably seen the same thing. But it really only takes about 5 seconds. So they need to see you do it and see that it can be done that fast. It takes about 5 seconds to chop a dough ball. Now, when you're starting out, of course, and you're doing 2 and 3 chops on a regular basis, it's going to be a little bit harder to chop in 5 seconds. But again, we want to just give them the idea this is what you want to work towards. It takes about 5 seconds to ball up a dough ball. And I've seen people take a lot of time balling up a dough ball, like they're making a snowball or something, just kind of doing this or whatever the case is. They just take way longer to do it. It's that careful mindset, I think. You want to do it just right and not working within a time frame. And then it takes about 5 seconds to oil the dough ball. So chopping dough, if you teach the 5-second rule, chopping dough will become a faster part in your store if you get everybody doing this. It'll just be a culture of fast dough choppers. That's just what happens. If you don't and you just allow speed to happen as it naturally does, you're going to have a lot of really slow people chopping dough in your store if you just leave it up to chance. So, all right. Let's look at another one, sheeting dough. It takes about 5 seconds to pound a dough ball and to make it round. One thing I recommend, too, when you're teaching people to sheet dough and you're teaching them that pounding stage, teach them the right way to kind of tuck it under and then pound it straight down so that your dough ball is round. I've seen people, like, just grab a hold of the dough ball with their fingers and get the fingerprints in it and just kind of throw it in there and just smash it down. They turn out kind of rectangle or square, or they have lips and creases in it. I would recommend that when you teach everybody, teach them to make it round. Take that extra second instead of doing it in 2 seconds. Do it in 3 seconds and make it round, because that'll save you on the stretching stage quite a bit. So it takes about 5 seconds to run it through the sheeter, and it takes about 5 seconds to stretch it onto the tray, unless, of course, you don't pound it well. If you don't pound it well, it's going to take you longer than that. You got to push those lips in and stretch it out and so on and so forth. So that's why it's important. And then it takes about 5 seconds to wrap a crust too. So if you do the math on here, you know, that's about 20, 25 seconds that it should take for each crust. But we've all seen people do this a lot longer than that, take a lot longer to sheet than this by being too perfectionistic and taking too long to pound or to stretch or whatever it is. All right. Another area we teach the 5-second rule is sauce and cheesing. So when I mean sauce and cheesing, I mean like doing it in a non-rush setting, preparing for the evening. Although I guess it applies to all pizzas anyway. So it takes about 5 seconds to unwrap a crust. Some people can do it much quicker than that, of course. It takes about 5 seconds to stretch out a crust. You know, when you get good, you can do it quicker than that, too. It takes about 5 seconds to apply sauce and spread it around. It takes people a lot longer than that to begin with, typically. Sometimes you'll see a new person come in and kind of get it quickly, but usually that saucing part can really trip people up. So take a few minutes, and I like to teach with the saucing bar, I like to teach the snowplow effect where you're kind of pushing it out to the outside and turning it with your other hand. And so once you practice that and get good at it, it should take about 5 seconds. It should take about 5 seconds to apply cheese and spread that out. We like I always tell people grab more cheese than what you need. That way you can sprinkle and clamp it off and put it back all in one motion, and then you spread it out and you're ready to go. And that takes about 5 seconds to wrap as well. So when it comes to sauce and cheesing, typically if you get a fast person doing it, you can do one crust, one sauce and cheese every 30 seconds. So in an hour, you could do 120 potentially if you're doing it this way. Okay. Well, those are the 5-second rules, and those are the four rules to production. I'm going to go ahead and open this up to discussion or questions. Feel free to share your own experience of things that you found that have to do with this or other ideas that you have. So you can unmute your your phone by hitting *6. So we'll go ahead and start.
Joel, this is Lori Murphy. Hi.
Hi, Lori.
Hi. What is your best practice for making sure that these processes are put into effect? And I mean, who is the one that's overseeing this? If you're not there, or if a manager is not there, how do you manage the productivity so that these habits are implemented at your store level?
Yeah, that's a good question, Lori. I think, you know, I think part of this, an easy way to answer this question would be that we really try to create a culture. We try to create a culture of just people changing the way they do it to doing it this way, and so that this actually becomes their new normal, as opposed to you know, a bunch of checklists or a bunch of accountability to make people do it in a way that they don't want to do it, if that makes sense. So that's why I think it's important for us to start when people are new. When we have new people come into the store, we begin by training them the right way from the very beginning and help them get there. Now, I think it takes a while. If you have a store, you know, for instance, years ago, 10 years ago, I bought 4 stores here in the Des Moines area that were just horribly run, and it took me a long time to turn those around. And so I couldn't just walk in and just tell everybody and kind of put these rules down and then expect them to do it. They just wouldn't do it. Nowadays, it's a little bit different because we have a culture in place that's doing it. So I think it depends on where you're starting from. But if you're starting from a place that these techniques are unfamiliar, I think you just need to start from the top and work down. Start with the general manager, and you need to get the buy-in. I don't think anybody is going to commit to doing some of these things if they don't see that they're real and that they work. So for me, I think it was proving it by doing it. So I got to work next to people. You know, I don't work next to my managers as much as I used to. But I think that's part of it. When you can prove it, when you can prove that you know, that you are fast, you can get things done, you're efficient, and the way you do it is by following simple principles. I think that's a lot of it, training and leading by example, and then working towards creating a culture, trying to get that buy-in. Hope that answers your question.
Yeah, thank you.
Lori, what are some of the things that you might struggle with in your stores in this area?
I'm sorry, what was that?
What would be some of the areas that you might struggle with in your stores?
Well, you know, we've gone through some big changes in our 3 stores in Portland, and we're rebuilding from the ground up. So we don't have some of the history or depth that we have had in the past. And I can't be at all 3 stores, so we're really, just what you said, we're building a new culture, and we're focused really heavily on shift leads, and you know, trying to get them so that they have bought in, so that then they're, as much depth as you can get in a store, the better off you are. Otherwise, everybody's running a little rogue,
right.
Which is what we've experienced in when we were without, you know, the depth that we have typically had.
Right. I think sometimes you have to get past the roadblock, or employees have to get past the roadblock of if the owner or manager puts something, some kind of principle in place like this that's a production principle, have to get past the idea that, oh, it's just another way to do it. It's not necessarily better. It's just this is how the boss wants it done, but I have a better way to do it. You know, you have to get past that. You have to actually help them be willing to see their blind spots and see some areas that they aren't very fast at, or they're not very efficient at, or things that cause them to be slow. You know, it's tough when you see a busybody just waste their time all day long, and you get to the end of the day and they have no idea where their time went, but yet they're not willing to listen or change the way that they think about things. That's mm-hmm. frustrating. And so getting people to first buy into what you're talking about and maybe even come to a place where they recognize that they're not as efficient as they could be. That's definitely a roadblock. A lot of people just think they're a lot faster than they are, especially multitaskers.
I think there's a tendency to speak to crew just about labor percentages, you know, what we're trying to hit for the day, and it's a too big of a goal. And really what you're doing, even by talking about a five-second rule, you're breaking it down into five-second increments instead of some sort of percentage goal that you're trying to hit for the day, which I think
right.
is an easier concept for kids especially to get their head around.
Right. Yeah, when you leave it open-ended on how quickly something needs to get done, even the little things, people just flounder. They just flounder working at their own normal. And it's amazing how much faster people can be if they can, you know, if they can be just taught, and if we use time framing to help them with that, you know, just framing a different time. Here's the thing about our normal speed too. If we're a slow poke and it feels normal to move slow, and we have a really good leader that teaches us and helps us to get faster and faster and faster by using these techniques, when you get fast, then that fast doesn't seem like more work than it did when you were slow. That's your new normal, so that's your normal speed. It's hard to work slower than that. We've all probably worked with those people that are really fast, and their normal is fast. They just do it fast all the time, and if there's somebody in their way, you know, then that makes them angry. It's like the guy that's speeding on the highway, and there's the grandpa going 40 miles per hour in front of them. And so that's the thing. We need to train people's minds to think that way, that their new normal becomes fast.
You know, we've also done direct and indirect timings where we'll time people when they know they're being timed, and then we'll time them when they don't know they're being timed, and there's can be a real difference between the two.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Or the time taken between tasks. You know, they might finish cheese and they might be going to doubles, but the time that it takes them to actually start the doubles from the cheese can be half an hour, you know, 20-30 minutes. Getting stuff ready, that sort of thing.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, there's a lot of ways we're very unproductive in this business, no doubt. Anybody else have any thoughts on production? How about the struggles with cleaning as you go? That 4 or 5 o'clock comes around and it's time to do the whole stack of dishes in the back. That's horrible. Anybody experience that?
Never, Joel, never. I don't know why nobody's chiming in. No, that never happens to us.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because it just feels so natural just to let things go. It just seems so simple just to go put it someplace and walk away from it and just leave it. and not worry about it. But it really does slow us down. You know, we clean as we go. It's just, it is so much more efficient. So,
you know, we talk about, you know, cleaning up after yourself, but again, I'm really getting something from what you're talking about, because I always say have everything clean and completed by 3 o'clock. But that doesn't really tell them to clean everything as they go,
right,
after they complete a task. It's leaving too much space for them to interpret what that means. And so by 3 o'clock, if it's not done, it's just sort of like, well, we missed one goal, but really you missed a lot of goals along the way.
Right. Yep. Yeah, no doubt. Anybody struggle with divide and conquer in your stores? I'm curious about that one. This one has been a tough one for us to really get in the majority of our stores for people to get, but the ones that do get it really get it, and those stores just run so much smoother. It's like people just don't buy into it necessarily right away.
Yeah, Joel, this is Ben, and I work with Laurie. I think that's actually a really important point. One of the things that we've gone through as we've rebuilt these teams is learning how to actually pass on responsibilities so that new ideas can come through. Because what we've seen is with the entrenched crew that have been there for more than a year, their agenda for that shift is usually quite different from our agenda. And achieving those productivity goals, we've had the best theory figured out, we've had the best order of work figured out, and it comes back to no one's tapped into that crew member's agenda during that shift. And I'm wondering if you've got experience with this, because it's part of divide and conquer. It's also part of the 5-second rule. And I think we're about to go into that level where we start getting more input from crew on how to achieve a better result on a shift. Can we get an hour? Can we finish an hour earlier? And then what's the incentive for doing that? So what's your experience with the holistic approach to that? And then what are the incentives for them to actually get that shift done an hour earlier than what has traditionally been that time?
Sure. Well, first, I think connecting with people is the most important. I don't think there's any substitute for that. You can have lots of checklists and rules in place with your crew, and I don't think you're going to tap into that agenda. You're just going to be working up against it if you just have a bunch of rules until you connect with them. If you can connect with your people and get on their page, find out what they think about things, ask them for their advice on things and on how they would do it, this and that, when you kind of have this transparency, when you get it out and talk about it, I think then we have the ability to come together and agree on a way to do something. And it could be that the crew contributes to what you have to offer as well. And, you know, like in our company, we have a red book that I mentioned last time that we use. And that red book is not something that I just sat down one day and just wrote. That red book was something that was from years and years of people contributing suggestions towards it. Us asking questions like, how can we improve this? What can we do to make it better? And it's the same way with these different rules here, handcuffing. You know, I didn't just sit down one day and say, you know what? Let's just start everybody teaming up all together. Let's just try that and see what happens. No, it happens because kind of organically, you start to see what works and what doesn't work, and you start to see what combinations of people work and what their thoughts are and how they believe it should be done. And when people start seeing what works and what doesn't, you start to emulate those people and try to ask questions, how are you doing that and why are you doing it that way? So I think that's part of it. You're right, though, Zen, that sometimes we don't take into consideration what the agenda of our crew is. Sometimes they might be walking in thinking, I'm here till 7, so at 7 o'clock I'm leaving at 7. They're not even thinking about what needs to be done or anything. They're just thinking about the clock. And I think that's where the connecting comes from, you know, where we can talk our people into position and sit down and talk with those people for about 2 or 3 minutes before they come on their shift, give them some goals, give them some some things to work on. Ask them, you know, some advice or questions, what they think we should do, or whatever the case might be. Make them feel like they have an input on it too. I think it's just getting on the same page too that way.
So. Yeah, just following that thought a bit further too, Joel, one of the things we did was we had a very clear couple of weeks where we did direct and indirect, and just following on from what Laurie was saying, we actually made termination decisions based on how some of the crew were frittering away their shift, because their goal was, I just want to get my hours, productivity. You've hired me for my hours, I'll show up, not my actual productivity. And what we've got is this very uneven day of shift work. The evening crew runs very efficiently. The prep crew, we've struggled to actually get productivity into the prep shift. And we keep saying, if we could just have a shift leader that could bring this shift in an hour early and give us the savings in labour, it sets up the afternoon in terms of an easier goal when it comes to labour and sales. So we've got this kind of fat and comfortable prep shift, and then we have these very efficient rush crews that are driven by customer transactions and that whole thing. What's your experience in evening it out so that it's there's more consistency within the culture of the store? We've done what we've been able to do so far, which are these. Our most powerful information are the indirect observations, when we know that someone takes 20 minutes between tasks, just kind of fritting around in the back, and then it's only 7 minutes to chop tomatoes. We've got that data, but it's what's your advice on how to make a better balance between prep shift and rush shift in terms of productivity?
Well, I think the principles are going to apply regardless of what shift it is. I think there are other stores that might have fast prep people and slow pizza makers.
Right.
So it kind of depends on the store. But I would say regardless of the shift, I think it's working on that culture. We have something that we talk about in our company with our leadership. It's called the 60-90 effect.
Yeah.
And here's how it works. If you allow somebody to work at 60%, they probably will. If you ask them to work at 90%, they may. So if they do, reward them. If they don't, then either retrain them or unhire them. And so I think people are going to work at a slow pace, and they're going to spend extra time in between tasks as long as we allow them to. You know, when we plan that way, when the culture is that that's okay to do that, I think that's where the problem comes. But also, we have to avoid the dictator, so we're not trying to just trying to squeeze blood out of a turnip with all of our employees. But the idea is that we don't try to get them to do something. We try to get them to want to do something. And so it's that connectedness that we have to do.
So to keep following that train of thought, one of the things we have done is developed a new form for shift lead accountability in that context, where they've actually set a plan for tasks with some indirect time in between tasks that's acceptable, with the goal of actually being able to bring a shift in on schedule with production and crew and finishing at an exact time. So we've got the form, we just haven't implemented it, but that's a result of doing timings and looking at crew performance. Because we also know that there's not that much value. If you know what your timings are and you schedule against your timings, you actually don't hit those goals. So we've put in some margin for unexpected things, like, you know, sometimes you'll have a piece of equipment break or something's late, kind of for whatever reason. But we've always struggled to try and pull that shift in. If we say by 3 o'clock, and then we say, okay, knowing the indirect timings and the time wasted between tasks, can we get this shift down to 2 o'clock? And we've never been able to do that. So now we're looking at, can we do it as a tracking mechanism at the shift lead level to see if there's ways to make that happen? Do you have experience with that? We get the bit about the store culture. We know that stuff, but what we've got is this, we're struggling to get this grip where there is an actual bona fide process as much as the culture.
Well, I think you need to diagnose what systems are not being used or not being used correctly, because there are systems in place for all of this. We've got prep chart, we've got a lot of different things in place. So I think you have to check your vital signs and figure out what is lacking first. If it's simply a disinterest, and so people are wasting time because they're disinterested, well, then you have a certain problem to fix with getting people interested. If it's not that, if they are interested and they're really trying and they're doing the best they can, but they're just really slow, well, then you might have some retraining on steps to do. If they're multitaskers and they're running around, you know, like a chicken with their head cut off, then there's the guardrails you need to put in place in order to get them to be single taskers, that kind of thing. So right. I think it just all depends on how you diagnose it and what the problem is. You may have a problem with different people. They may all have something different going on. You know.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's hard to know without knowing the situation.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I feel like I've talked too much. And Joel, I love your phrase unhire. that one made me smile. It's like, yeah, we've done a fair bit of unhiring.
Yeah.
So thank you.
No doubt. Yep. Anybody else have any thoughts before we get off the call here? Got about 3 or 4 minutes left. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for being on the call, and we'll see you next month.